This is the Crime Story Podcast with Carrie Antholis, where stories of crime and justice are told. On today's podcast, we present an exclusive conversation with Eric Siddall, Vice President of the ADDA, the Professional Association for Deputy District Attorneys of Los Angeles County. Siddall joins me to discuss the first year of Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon's term in office. In a November New York Times article entitled, "He's Remaking Criminal Justice in L.A., But How Far Is Too Far?" Emily Bazelon and Jennifer Medina compare the tenures of reform-oriented prosecutors Kim Fox in Chicago and Larry Krasner in Philadelphia to George Gascon's experience here in Los Angeles. Both Fox and Krasner won re-election even as the murder rates in their cities climbed significantly. According to Bazelon and Medina, their victory showed that district attorneys could stand for progressive change and survive a rise in violent crime. But those elections differed somewhat from Gascon's situation in Los Angeles, as he faces a second effort to recall him. They suggested the political wisdom of making careful case-by-case decisions about releasing people who have committed serious acts of violence. And with that context, here is my interview with Eric Siddall. Eric Siddall, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to take you back to December of 2020, just before George Gascon was sworn in as the new district attorney in Los Angeles County. Can you take us through what your expectations were for his tenure as DA?
I think I was expecting more moderation. You know, generally people run on a more radical platform, and then when they become a part of the institution, you start to see more moderation. I think it's probably the same expectation that a lot of people had when Donald Trump took over the presidency. A lot of people thought, well, he can't be as nuts as he sounds in public. I mean, eventually the institution, in that case, the presidency, was going to moderate him. And, you know, the institutions would hold. I thought the same would happen, or I thought some type of hope like that was going to happen with Gascon, where, again, he would come into office, but the institution of a public prosecution agency was going to really hold firm, and that the institutions would basically moderate the campaign rhetoric. I think we were all very surprised when we started hearing rumors on the morning of December 7th that he was going to completely abandon all enhancements, three strikes, and that he was going to stop prosecuting certain types of misdemeanors. And at that moment, after the directives came through, I realized, wow, this is going to be kind of like a Trumpian district attorney's office, where a more radical, anti-institutional leader was taking over the office.
So when Gascon took office, did he make an effort to get to know the rank and file? Did he do any sort of outreach to the people that were working for him?
No. He came in. He brought in his directives. The directives were not really discussed within the rank and file. He just said, these are going to be the directives. And here's the problem is that he's been up in San Francisco. He has not really been in Los Angeles for, you know, quite some time, probably like, 15 years. So he doesn't really understand Los Angeles. He also doesn't know the district attorney's office. He made no effort to learn about the district attorney's office. And then he put in a person to run the office who also had no experience, who was brand new to the DA's office, who had no trial experience. I think the guy had like 4 trials under his belt. I have about 80. So it's problematic when you come into an institution and you just completely disregard the entire institution and you don't rely on the deep bench of experience and expertise that this office has. And that, I think, was extremely frustrating to a lot of line deputies, because really there's no expertise up in the management that understands what's going on in Los Angeles. And you know, he added to that by putting in a couple public defenders who are prison abolitionists. And then he brought in his former chief of staff from San Francisco, who, from what I understand, still lives in San Francisco, but she commutes down to come and work here. So there was no getting to learn the institution. One of the things we were told was that he was going to bring in a McKinsey-style analysis into the office, and he was going to redesign the office through that. But there was no management consultant that I know of that was actually eventually used. It's been these ad hoc changes once the directives started. And again, these ad hoc changes don't really rely on any type of objective metric or evaluation.
And the actions that the deputy district attorneys brought against the DA, what were those legal actions and what was the result of those actions?
So when the directives were announced, and it was clear that these directives were not written by prosecutors, they were written by defense lawyers. In fact, one of the directives even had the word client in there when they were referring to the defendant. And that's a term used by defense lawyers, not by prosecutors. No prosecutor ever considers the defendant their client. So it was very clear that these directives were written by defense lawyers. And the directives themselves went contrary to our ethical obligations as prosecutors to follow the law. There were two particular elements that were illegal. And if we had followed this, we would have been breaking the law and breaking our duty of candor to the court. One was he basically abolished three strikes, the three strikes law. And three strikes is one of those rare pieces of legislation that was passed by both the voter directly and also the legislature, where it limits the discretion of a prosecutor on what to file and what they cannot file. Three strikes requires the filing of prior strikes. In other words, if you've committed a violent or serious felony in the past, you are required as a prosecutor to file those charges. And he told us not to. So there was a conflict there. Do you follow the elected leader or do you follow the law? And that ethical dilemma was one of the reasons why we filed a lawsuit enjoining the district attorney from implementing that particular directive. The other directive that he implemented, again, clearly not written by a prosecutor, clearly written by a defense lawyer, was he ordered us to dismiss enhancements, conduct enhancements. So, for example, if you commit a robbery but you use a gun, the law allows a prosecutor to charge that additional conduct so that the punishment properly reflects the conduct committed by the defendant. And so he told us that we had to dismiss existing charges. Well, the problem, again, with that is that there is substantial decisional authority, in other words, case law, that says you can only dismiss something if it's in the interest of justice. And just because a elected official believes something is not sufficient to meet that legal definition of the interest of justice. It's a defined term, and it's defined by years and years of judicial decisions. So it was those two main aspects that we had a problem with because it put us directly in conflict with the law. As prosecutors, you have a very different ethical standard than defense lawyers. You have to follow the law. You have to prosecute cases in an ethical way. We have very different ethical duties in terms of what we're supposed to give over to the defense. And this was two basic things that were directly in conflict with our ethics. So we sued him in Superior Court, and that judge issued a temporary injunction against the district attorney. It's pretty unprecedented that something like that happened. It's a pretty rare occasion that a district attorney is told that he must follow the law. You know, that's one of his primary duties is to enforce the law. So it was a pretty remarkable decision by Judge Chalfant to say, you need to follow the law. And he has appealed that decision. Clearly, he doesn't agree with it. But I think what's interesting is that there's a precedent of this. When Donald Trump ordered his Justice Department to dismiss charges against one of his former national security advisor who had been convicted, the court there also had some trouble with the idea that you can just abandon a prosecution. That's very much against our legal tradition, especially our legal tradition in the United States over the past 150 years, that just one individual can decide to abandon a prosecution. So the judge issued an injunction and we were able to have that be enforced over the past year.
What is the practical effect of Judge Chalfant's decision been on the DA's office?
The practical application is that we no longer just dismiss something because the district attorney feels like it should be dismissed, especially on a prior filing. One of the things that makes the American legal tradition and the American system very different from others is that this idea of checks and balances. And it's not just the word of a leader that carries the day. That's not the law. The law is created by the legislature. It's interpreted by the judiciary and the executive branch, which the DA is the leader of the executive branch in terms of prosecution, is there to carry out and enforce the law. So this decision, the practical decision was that that balance was restored. And it wasn't, again, just one man deciding what the law will be and shall be. And so it was a pretty important decision because it not only restored the balance of power, but it also allowed our deputies to behave ethically without the interference of a DA who was telling us to act unethically.
Has the district attorney shown any signs of moderating his position?
I think that's another thing that has been rather sad about what has been going on in the district attorney's office for the past year. It's quite telling that he really has not moderated any of his positions. He continues to be defiant in his worldview. And really, his worldview is that the current criminal justice system must be torn down and then rebuilt in some other image. I don't know where he thinks he gets that authority. It's not within his job description in terms of his constitutional role to do such a thing. But that's basically his philosophy, is that we need to destroy the entire system and then rebuild it. We're not quite sure in what image he wants to rebuild it, but I think that is his overall goal.
Tell me more about the practical effects of his decisions and his policies with respect to crime in the Los Angeles area.
Again, it's kind of interesting because it's really, there are these very big policy pronouncements, and yet there's very little fidelity to carry them out. So some of the big policy announcements are, you know, he doesn't charge gang crimes anymore, or he doesn't charge gang enhancements anymore. He does not use the gun enhancement to the fullest extent of the law when they apply to, especially when they apply to violent felonies. So there is this limited toolbox that he allows us to use in terms of enforcing the laws, which is especially troubling when we have a growing crime trend. There is a trend that is occurring right now. Crime is growing, especially violent crime. The most reliable statistic probably to indicate whether crime is up or down is homicides, because homicide statistics cannot be manipulated because of the obvious issue that there's a dead body and you can't really manipulate that. And what we do see is that there has been a trend for the past 2 years of an increase in violent crime. We have also seen a district attorney who has decided that he is not going to hold criminals fully accountable for those violent crimes. So in one sense, you kind of have him saying that he is not going to hold people accountable. And we see, especially what I've heard our gang members saying, that Uncle Gascon is going to take care of them. We've seen people taken into custody for felon with a possession of a firearm, and they're almost immediately released. Sometimes charges are not pressed against them until much later. And so there's little accountability of felons with a firearm, which in my opinion is one of the most dangerous crimes out there, because if you're a felon, in particular, if you're a gang member with a gun, that usually means that you're out for no good. So you don't have that accountability. On the other hand, he has been announcing these very large and epic diversion programs. And the problem I have with the diversion programs, it's not really the problem with diversion, but there's a lack of fidelity to the metrics and the evaluation, which is really the foundation of evidence-based policy implementation. There are no metrics, there's no evaluation that he's using to see whether these diversion programs are successful. And we should be concerned about that, because that means there's a lack of transparency in this office. And you, the public, should care about transparency, especially when it involves diversion, because we should know, are these programs successful? Are they actually reducing recidivism? And you really don't have that with this administration.
Where do you think we go from here? The first attempt at a recall was not successful. I gather that we're coming to the end of the window where someone could start a recall campaign again. What is your view of where that's going to go?
Yesterday, January 20th, actually, I think it was January 27th, Thursday, the Register's office approved a new recall petition. This new recall effort has about $2.7 or $2.9 million ready to spend. And I know that they're still going to raise a few million dollars more for this recall effort. You know, I generally don't support recalls. I voted against the recall of Gavin Newsom because to me, there was no legitimate reason to recall him. I generally don't like recalls. However, I don't see what else we can do. When you have a district attorney who refuses to follow the law, who has made questionable ethical decisions, has violated civil service rules in terms of his hiring political cronies to run the district attorney's office, his lack of creating metrics and evaluation to determine the success of diversion programs, the lack of transparency in general with his office, the refusal to honor public records requests made. You know, our organization has made many, many public records requests. He has refused to honor those requests. I think when someone is blatantly acting outside of their constitutional duties and disregarding the law, that is a reason to recall that person. He has no plan to deal with the rising violence. So at this point, I personally am supporting a recall. I'm not sure what the Association of Deputy District Attorneys will do in terms of that recall, but it's time for him to go. He's had 1 year to implement his social experiments. They're not working. And I think this new recall effort does have some legs. I think the public is tired of what's going on. I'm not sure the public is willing to have 3 more years of social experiments without any results.
I do want to ask you about the perspective on Gascon from defense attorneys, and particularly from public defenders and bar panel attorneys. Anecdotally, you speak to a lot of defense attorneys pretty regularly, I imagine. What is your sense of how Gascon is doing from their perspective?
There's two things. First of all, a lot of defense lawyers live in Los Angeles and care about what happens in LA. So the ones I've spoken to seem concerned about his inability to recognize that Los Angeles does have a gang problem, does have a gun problem, and that there's a need to tackle those issues. The other issue I think that they have is there really hasn't been a remarkable shift in terms of plea bargains and sentencing. I don't think that the DA has taken a very strategic look about how to reduce sentencing on minor criminals or minor participants and really focus his energy on giving longer sentences to those who really instigate crime, who are the motivators of crime, the real drivers of crime. That's always been a criticism that I've had of how prosecutions is done in the DA's office. I always thought we should be much more strategic, smarter about disabling gangs. In other words, if we really focus our efforts on the certain individuals who motivate a gang, who really bring it to life, who are the drivers of violence and gun-related crimes, you could basically have that person spend a significant amount of time in prison and yet not have to put his accomplices in for the same amount of time. In other words, give them lower sentences, focus on the prime actors. And I don't think that that's really been happening. We're not being any smarter about our plea bargains than we were in the past 20 years.
How does a recall election for DA work? And who do you see as the challengers who might emerge if a recall petition receives enough validated signatures?
The way that the recall occurs for district attorney is similar to the recall of any other statewide office. The signature gatherers have to gather 10% of the last election. Those signatures have to be valid. They have to be from Los Angeles County. They have to be registered voters. Their signatures have to be verified. And then the Register's office also has all these rather arcane rules about how each signature has to be within the box of the signature box. It's a rather arcane procedure in terms of gathering the signatures. So once the signatures are validated and he is put on the ballot, there will be two questions. The first question will be, do you want to recall George Gascon? The second question will be, who should replace him? I think the main focus is to gather the signatures and get him on the ballot. In terms of who would replace him, I think there will be plenty of good candidates out there. It's really speculative at this point who's going to challenge him. But what I would hope is someone that understands where we are in terms of the criminal justice movement, what is expected, how to implement criminal justice reform in a smart and thoughtful way, in a manner that actually shows fidelity to the matrix and truly evaluates these, you know, evidence-based programs and makes sure that we're doing this in a, not just in a way to reform the system, but in a way to make sure that we are all safer and better overall after these reforms take place. Someone who's going to take into consideration that homicides in this county are out of control, that they are gang-related, they are gun-related, and that there is a disparate impact that's occurring when these homicides are raging. You know, there's a lot of focus right now on these very influential cases that are happening in neighborhoods like the Fairfax District or in Beverly Hills, and that is really taking a lot of the media attention. But Florence Firestone has had a 300% increase in the homicide rate. Watts has had a huge increase. In fact, in 1 6-month period, it increased 150% in terms of the homicide rate. So while we have been focusing on these celebrity killing and a killing that is just a horrible human loss, that human loss has been occurring at a very rapid rate in minority districts within Los Angeles. And someone also needs to recognize that people of color are really bearing the brunt of this increase in crime. So I would hope that's what someone would actually do when they would take over the office, is show compassion and leniency to people who are entering the criminal justice system in a manner to make sure that they never come back into the criminal justice system. But for those people who are causing havoc and wreaking violence, especially in the south parts of our city and our county, that we really take a hard look at how do we disrupt gang violence, how do we disrupt gun violence, and how do we keep people protected so that they can live a prosperous life in every community in Los Angeles, not just in communities in the west side of Los Angeles.
In the latter part of last year, there was also a report about the enduring presence of gangs in the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Can you give me your perspective on that?
That's a matter that the sheriff needs to address. I don't know if the term gang is the right term for it. We should always expect our law enforcement to behave in an ethical and outstanding way. They should always be models for the public, and we always want to make sure that our law enforcement behaves in a professional manner, and that really should be the standard. I think to use the term gang is to really dilute what the word really means in the criminal justice context. But people who do not behave professionally, whether they're prosecutors, whether they're police officers, they shouldn't be a part of our system. And that's the job of each executive, to manage their departments and to manage it well and to manage it so that the public has confidence that their public servants are behaving in an ethical and professional manner.
I'd like to just go a little bit further with that. I think I understand why you're critical of using the word gangs, but I do think that some of the behavior of these cliques or groups or subgroups mimics some of the activity of criminal organizations and some of the behavior that's reported in the RAND report. And I know that they opt not to refer to these groups as gangs, but if you can just give me your assessment of how severe the problem is in your view in the sheriff's department and what steps the sheriff should be taking to deal with this, I'd appreciate it.
There's a reason why RAND doesn't use the term gang, and I don't feel I can use it. I also don't think I have like the expertise on this particular issue because it's not something that I've done as a prosecutor. We have a unit within our office that is composed of very respected prosecutors who examine our justice partners, particularly the Sheriff's Department and LAPD. And I think that if there's an issue of criminal behavior, I'm very confident that both the United States Attorney's Office and the JSID division of the DA's office would deal with it. People think that if someone is behaving in a criminal manner, whatever their role is, whether they are a police officer, or a civilian, especially if they're in a position of power, that has to be taken seriously and it has to be dealt with. As for the sheriff and how he runs the department, again, I don't claim to be an expert on how a police department is organized. That's not my level of expertise. And I think one of the things I've always been very critical of this current district attorney is that I do not think he has the expertise to be a prosecutor. He doesn't know what it means to be a prosecutor. He's never tried a case. And I think that's problematic. It's problematic when we don't listen to our experts. So I think it would be also problematic for me to give an opinion about something I don't believe I'm an expert on.
Fair enough. Eric, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about with respect to the city, with respect to crime and law enforcement and the criminal legal process in the city that you haven't had a chance to say so far?
No, I think we've covered a lot in terms of what's been going on. I do think one of the things that is misunderstood is, you know, right now with this crime wave, we don't really know what the driver is. You know, I have a suspicion about what are the causes of this increase in homicides. And I believe it's both the increase of guns, just talking to officers when they're engaged in search warrants, they're seeing a lot more guns being recovered than they have in the past. In other words, before you would find a gang would have one gun. Now, one gang member may have six guns and three or four of them may be ghost guns. So we have this huge increase in illegal firearms. I'm not talking about legal firearms. I'm talking about illegal firearms. And at the same time, there has been a retreat to proactively enforce a lot of laws to make sure that the guns are off the street. And I think there is this combination that is increasing the level of violence, the level of shootings and homicides that we see throughout Los Angeles County. And I think the lack of accountability is a motivator for the increase in crime. But the truth is, we don't truly know what is driving this new increase.
That dovetails with one other thing that I did want to ask you about, which is the impact of COVID on crime and the criminal justice system and the legal process in Los Angeles. What's your sense of that?
There has been some speculation that the increase in crime has to do with COVID. There's been some reporting in the New York Times that that may not be the case. And I don't think that that is one of the main drivers. If we look at the first 4 months of the pandemic, there was not an increase in crime. We only saw an increase in crime starting in June onward, which also coincides at the time when law enforcement was standing down in lots of areas. So I don't think that the COVID issue is increasing crime. What it has done is it's created a huge backlog of cases because the courts have been effectively closed in terms of jury trials. So the only way to settle a case now is either through a plea bargain. And we have had a few trials, but we haven't really had that many trials. And we're not really capable right now of doing a lot of trials because we can't get jurors in a safe way and maintain their safety for a duration of a trial. So the main impact that COVID has had is that it has created a huge backlog within the criminal justice system. But I want to bring up this idea that somehow crime has gone up because of COVID. You know, one of the best ways to kind of see what's going on with crime is, like I said, homicide rates are a good indicator because there's no way that you can manipulate that statistic. And also, you don't need someone to report the crime because there is obvious evidence of the crime through the fact that it's a homicide. That's one of the best indicators of where violent crime is. The United States Department of Justice does a survey every year of victimization. And that's also a really great way of seeing where crime really is. And one of the things that the survey always talks about is the fact that crime in the United States is underreported. Whether it's violent crime or thefts, it's always underreported. The reason is because either people don't have faith in the criminal justice system, they don't have faith in their police, they don't think anything's going to happen, or they're also afraid of reporting the crime. And you see a lot of that in gang-related robberies, for example. There's a fear of reporting because you don't want the reprisal. You don't want someone to take action against you because you've reported a crime. We have a definite deficit of underreporting of crime in Los Angeles County. That's pretty well known. It's documented. And really what we need to do is we need to analyze how do we make sure that this trend doesn't become a long-term trend. It doesn't continue. I think one of the ways that you do is a traditional way is you have accountability. And right now, we don't see too much accountability within the criminal justice system, especially within this district attorney's office, where accountability is not really the gold standard anymore.
Eric Siddall, thank you so much for joining us today. Look forward to having you back as the months of 2022 progress.
Well, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate it.
That concludes my interview with Eric Siddall, Vice President of the Los Angeles Association of Deputy District Attorneys. For more storytelling, news, and narrative analysis in the world of crime and justice, head on over to crimestory.com. Thank you for joining us, and we hope you will come back for the next Crime Story podcast.